We're about to get an answer to the age-old question, can you be confirmed Attorney General of the United States, over the objection of 1,400 law professors?
Hilarious.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair, and I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right, here I am stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., and Radio Sputnik, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us today for another thrilling, action-packed adventure as Senate confirmation hearings begin for Donald Trump's nominees to his cabinet. We will talk momentarily about Jeff Sessions, Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, Alabama senator, who will now who has been nominated as the choice for U.S. Attorney General, despite his years of racially discriminatory behavior, actions, comments, and more. We will focus on that, his civil rights record and his voting rights record, in a bit here. This was the first of the confirmation hearings to get underway. They're going to come like a storm, like a tidal wave, like a tsunami over the next few days. Desi Doyen, and you're already looking exhausted from just following the hearings with Jeff Sessions.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot to
it
cover.
Is.
It's a lot to keep track of. You know, it's just sort of the entire civil rights history of the United States squeezed into just a couple of hours.
Oh, that's it. Yeah,
yeah,
and they're rushing
easy,
them
peasy.
Exactly, and they're rushing them through, and they're all
yes.
happening. They're going to be happening here over the next few days, all at once. There was one change. There was supposed to be on Wednesday. There were five different hearings in various Senate committees all going on at once. Now the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee has moved their hearing for Betsy DeVos, who's been nominated for Education Secretary. They've moved that to January 17. But the other four continue. The second day of hearings for Jeff Sessions, the hearing for Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, CEO of ExxonMobil, that's going on at the same time. The hearing for the CIA director, nominated Congressman Mike Pompeo, and the nomination for the Transportation Secretary, Elaine Chao, who just happens to be the wife of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. So all of these are going on at the same time. They've all been scheduled at the same time. I would suggest it is no accident. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, as I mentioned, told Democrats they should grow up if they don't like it. Even though he asked for a very similarly thorough review of Barack Obama's nominees back in 2009. In a letter back in 2009 to then Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, McConnell requested that the nominees' FBI background checks, the Office of Government Ethics review, and financial disclosure statements were all complete, quote, prior to a hearing being noticed. Well, that was something that Mitch McConnell demanded back in 2009. He doesn't demand it now because the Office of Government Ethics, the director of that office over the weekend, said that they have not even been able to complete the background checks for many of these nominees, even though their nomination hearings are now or any day now. The Kentucky Senator McConnell said that this complete set of information back then in 2009 was necessary to, quote, ensure that the Senate has had the opportunity to fairly review a nominee's record and to make a fair decision prior to a vote. Nonetheless, this is all moving forward, despite the fact that the OGE, the Office of Governmental Ethics, the director there, wrote on Saturday that two senior Democrats that the crammed hearing schedule has left his office unable to complete ethics review for several of the Trump picks, including the education secretary. nominee, Betsy DeVos. Perhaps that's why DeVos's hearing has been moved back by a few days, as well as Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. He is scheduled to have his hearings begin on Thursday. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said that the letter from McConnell back in 2009 and the fact that McConnell felt one thing then, a different thing now, proves that Trump's transition team was colluding with Senate Republicans, quote, to jam through these cabinet appointees, these cabinet nominees, before they have been thoroughly vetted. And it was actually kind of funny, Des, I don't know if you saw this, Chuck Schumer actually took the letter that McConnell had sent to Harry Reid back in 2009. Did you see this? He posted it on the Twitters.
It's hilarious.
He crossed out the actual letter. He crossed out the name, you know, to Harry Reid. He changed that to Mitch McConnell, and Dear Harry was changed to Dear Mitch. He just scratched out Mitch McConnell's. Yeah, with a Sharpie, scratched out Mitch McConnell's signature at the end, put his own on it and sent it. And even at the top, the letterhead says Office of the Republican Leader. He just scratched out Republican, changed it to Office of the Democratic Leader, and sent the same letter back to Mitch McConnell, in which McConnell had said had described the best practices that he insisted upon for advice and consent on presidential nominees. And the duty which he says we take seriously, he said these best practices serve the Senate well, and we will insist on their fair and consistent application. And one of those things he insisted on at the time, number two here in a lengthy list, the Office of Government Ethics letter must be complete and submitted to the committee in time for review and prior to a committee hearing. So that's what he sent back to him. But Mitch McConnell does not seem to be so interested in that. As a matter of fact, none of the Republicans seem to be particularly interested in following precedent from previous years. Democratic lawmakers, according to Politico, have now been able to secure testimony from congressional Black caucus members this week at the confirmation hearing for Jeff Sessions as attorney general. However, as California Senator Dianne Feinstein, she's the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, Feinstein said she had approached the chairman of the committee, Chuck Grassley, last week with this request to allow, among others, Congressman John Lewis and other congressional Black caucus members to appear before the committee to discuss Jeff Sessions' nomination and his record, to discuss his nomination to be the nation's top cop. The Iowa Republican Grassley was willing to allow them to testify, but on the condition that the lawmakers appear only after a group of outside witnesses testify about Jeff Sessions. Democrats were miffed at the offer, viewing it as an insult to lawmakers who typically appear before non-lawmaker witnesses testify. They also saw it as an attempt by Republicans to bury what would be high-profile testimony from Congressman Lewis, who is a civil rights icon, having marched across the Selma Bridge in Montgomery, Alabama, in the fight for voting rights, not only marched across the bridge, but got beaten to a bloody pulp in that march.
By police,
thank you. Feinstein said, I was pleased when Chairman Grassley agreed to make this possible. However, I regret that they will have to wait until after a 9-member panel speaks. Asking 3 members of Congress to sit and wait until the end of the hearing to testify, likely at the same time the Senate will be holding important budget votes, she says, is deeply unfair. Democrats pointed out that the committee's past practices has been to have lawmakers testify when they testify at these things, to have lawmakers testify before non-members, before non-Congress people. During John Ashcroft's attorney general confirmation hearing, for example, back in 2001, the same committee, hosted a panel of lawmakers who had also worked with John Ashcroft, who was a senator. The panel of lawmakers discussed the former Missouri senator's nomination. That panel included several Democrats, several Republicans, and they went, they spoke, they gave their testimony after Ashcroft was finished, but before a separate group of outside witnesses testified at the hearing. And Democrats want the same treatment for the Congressional Black Caucus members at Sessions' hearing. But they are apparently not going to get it. That is
so
not
much
how Grassley
for professional would... courtesy.
Indeed. Well, it, you know, depends which professionals, I suppose. Cory Booker, Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey, is one of those in the Black Caucus who is hoping to testify. He is opposing Sessions, and it marks the first time in the chamber's history that a sitting U.S. senator has testified against another sitting U.S. senator who's up for a cabinet job. Usually they're very nice to each other in these hearings when it comes to their colleagues, when their colleagues are testifying. Booker said, "I do not take lightly the decision to testify against a Senate colleague, but the immense powers of the Attorney General combined with the deeply troubling views of this nominee is a call to conscience," said Senator Booker. When Booker was talking about the civil rights record of this particular nominee, we've spoken about it on this show quite a bit since his nomination. But Ari Berman over at The Nation put together a piece yesterday that really highlights a lot of troubling matters from Jeff Sessions' record in Alabama, where he served as the attorney general. He also served as a U.S. attorney there under Ronald Reagan. His nomination to become a federal judge, however, was turned down back in 1986 due to his woeful civil rights record at the time. And he was one of the few, very few in American history to be turned down for a federal judgeship after a hearing in the U.S. Senate. But Ari Berman wrote a bit more about Sessions' troubling record. Over at The Nation, he writes, on September 12, 1986, Earl McGee, a 29-year-old African-American man, was convicted of murdering his ex-wife and another student. In Selma, Alabama, he was sentenced to death. Though the trial took place in Selma's Dallas County, which was 55% black, and the birthplace of the Voting Rights Act, McGee was convicted by an all-white jury because prosecutors struck all 24 eligible African-American jurors from the case. Six black jurors were removed for, quote, low intelligence, according to the prosecution. As Alabama's attorney general from 1995 to 1997, Jeff Sessions defended the prosecutor's actions that took place in the 80s when the case was appealed, when the death sentence case was appealed. The district attorney for Dallas County, Roy Johnson, who oversaw the McGee prosecution, had also recommended that Sessions prosecute three longtime civil rights activists in Alabama for voter fraud. A trial that Sessions lost, all of those voting rights activists were found not guilty. And it was, in fact, that case against those civil rights activists claiming they committed fraud when they did not. It was that case and that trial that contributed to Sessions being blocked for his federal judgeship in 1986. But when he was the attorney general, says Brian Stevenson, the renowned civil rights lawyer and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, when he was attorney general, we had a horrific problem of racial bias in jury selection, Stevenson says. Before Sessions took office, courts had reversed 23 cases where there had been intentional exclusion of people of color on juries, and his office defended most of those cases. Sessions' office. He was defending the prosecutor's conduct in the McGee case, where all 24 eligible African-American jurors were struck, and he was saying that it was not unconstitutional or illegal or discriminatory, despite that all of those African-Americans who were qualified for jury service were excluded from the case. Stevenson argued McGee's case on appeal, and in 2009, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit agreed with him and vacated the death sentence, citing, quote, intentional discrimination by the prosecution and an astonishing pattern resulting from the total exclusion of African Americans. When his sentence was overturned, McGee had been on death row in Alabama for 23 years. Alabama became the first state to bring back the use of chain gangs in 1995. a remnant of Jim Crow, and Sessions, as Alabama's attorney general at the time, defended it as, quote, perfectly proper. The chain gangs were later scrapped after a year due to a federal lawsuit. As a U.S. senator since 1997, Sessions, quote, is one of the few Republican legislators who does not support bipartisan efforts to reform the nation's criminal justice system, according to a new report by the Brennan Center for Justice. Sessions personally blocked bipartisan legislation supported by the Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley and House Speaker Paul Ryan, which would have reduced unnecessarily long sentences for nonviolent crimes. But Sessions was against it. He opposed consent decrees between the Justice Department and cities like Ferguson and Baltimore in order to reduce police misconduct. He called that one of the most dangerous and rarely discussed exercises of raw power. He opposes efforts to end mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenses or to decriminalize marijuana. He says last year, he said, quote, good people don't smoke marijuana. More than any other nominee for attorney general in modern American history, Ari Berman writes, Sessions would be an unapologetic defender of the old Confederacy and has refused to criticize policies that stem directly from Jim Crow. For example, Alabama's 1901 Constitution still includes language authorizing a poll tax and segregated schools. Interracial marriage was illegal in the state until 2000. Interracial marriage was still illegal as of 2000 in the state of Alabama. When Sessions was the attorney general there, there were still officially segregated proms in the state. He brought no cases to stop them, apparently. Last year, after the massacre of 9 African Americans in Charleston, South Carolina, Alabama Governor Robert Bentley removed the Confederate flag from the grounds of the Alabama State House. When he was asked about it, Sessions, who is named after a Confederate general, said, I'm not going to criticize the governor, but he went on to defend Confederate history anyway. He said, quote, and remember, this is just last year. He said, quote, this is a huge part of who we are. And the left is continually seeking in a host of different ways, it seems to me. I don't want to be too paranoid about this, he said, but they seek to legitimize the fabulous accomplishments of our country. That in response to the removal of the Confederate flag in Alabama following the mass murder of African Americans in a Charleston, South Carolina church last year. That shooter, by the way, today was sentenced to the death sentence in those shootings. Nonetheless, Sessions wants to be too careful about not delegitimizing the fabulous accomplishments of our country. Senator Bernie Sanders, who is not on the Judiciary Committee, which is holding its hearings, but Bernie Sanders was on a town hall on Monday on CNN, and he was asked by a member of the audience about Jeff Sessions' view on voting rights and how Bernie Sanders planned to vote confirmation of Senator Jeff Sessions.
Senator, I am worried about the direction of the Department of Justice over the next 4 years, specifically on voting rights. In light of Senator Sessions' history attacking the Voting Rights Act, will you oppose his confirmation?
I'm going to listen to what Jeff Sessions has to say. I've known Jeff for many, many years, but I have very, very strong concerns. And I think the issue you raise about the Voting Rights Act and how the Supreme Court a few years ago gutted the Voting Rights Act, and that right now in state after state, Republican states, what they are doing, this is really kind of unbelievable when you think about it. They're working overtime not to expand democracy, not to bring more people into the political process. They are trying to make it harder for people to vote under the guise of voter fraud. Thank God in America, voter fraud is very, very rare. But they're using that argument to make it harder for poor people, for old people, for people of color to vote. I consider this to be one of the most significant issues facing our country. Okay, so I will listen very, very carefully to what Senator Sessions has to say, but I share your concerns.
Thank you.
And, of course, I share those concerns, too, given that Jeff Sessions has not lifted a finger, in fact, to restore the Voting Rights Act since it was gutted by the Supreme Court in 2013. So I was listening very close, as I know you were, Des, to comments on a whole bunch of stuff that was brought up in the hearing by Democrats. Republicans were largely lauding Jeff Sessions for being a wonderful person. That's what they do. Democrats, on the other hand, were actually asking about issues of concern. Politely, very politely, as seems to be the case whenever one of their own, fellow senators comes up.
Very politely.
Yes. Am I putting it too nicely to say that?
No, I think that you're accurately characterizing it. That it's like a sort of an extreme over politeness, actually.
Yeah, especially given the issues that we're talking about. And I didn't, go check out Ari Berman's article over at The Nation, headlined "Jeff Sessions Could Return Criminal Justice to the Jim Crow Era," just to get a sense. I only read a part of it. But there were senators that were, in fact, asking about his civil rights record and his voting rights record. Most of them seem to be from Minnesota, but we'll get to that in a quick moment. Let's take a quick break, and we will come back with some extended excerpts from today's hearing in the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee in the confirmation hearings for Senator Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions. For U.S. Attorney General, I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Hey, it's Brad, and you're listening to the Bradcast on Radio Sputnik.
Yeah. Ooh, that's why I'm easy. I'm easy like Sunday morning.
Way too easy. Way too easy. As far as I'm concerned, when it came to the questioning of Senator, and it's not I called him Jeffrey before the break, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, senator from Alabama who has been nominated as Attorney General. It was, so far at least, it's been very easy. The questions from the U.S. senators. We'll see if things change tomorrow when witnesses actually come up. Concerning Sessions' character and who they are, whether we'll be able to see them, I don't know, because we've got five different hearings all going on at once. I don't even know that C-SPAN doesn't even have that many channels.
I know.
So, some of these things just won't be aired, much less the ability to actually look at them. I think Lindsey Graham's joke was probably the most accurate concerning what will likely come from these hearings. He made a joke. He was referring to the fact that some 1,400 law school attorneys, I guess, law school professors or attorneys from around the country have said Jeff Sessions should not be confirmed as Attorney General,
along
given his history.
Along with a number of civil rights groups and petitions, they've received a lot of pushback on this nomination.
They have, but to Lindsey Graham in the U.S. Senate and his fellow Republican, Jeff Sessions, that was all just a hilarity.
We're about to get an answer to the age-old question, can you be confirmed Attorney General of the United States over the objection of 1,400 law professors? I don't know what the betting line in Vegas is, but I like your chances.
Yes, he does, and for good reason, if you watch these hearings. I want to play some extended excerpts, and I want to focus here on the voting rights and the civil rights, but specifically on voting rights, since we cover that a lot here. Let's put those first with these extended excerpts. And as it turns out, and I don't say this just because our affiliate in Minneapolis, St. Paul, AM 950, is fantastic. But in fact, it was the Minnesota senators, both Senator Amy Klobuchar and Senator Al Franken, who seem to be the ones really pressing him, pressing Jeff Sessions on his record. And even they were kind of nice. But let's let you decide. First up here, Senator Amy Klobuchar, she asked Sessions about his opposition to fixing the Voting Rights Act since it was gutted by the Supreme Court. And about his comments about the Voting Rights Act, a landmark piece of civil rights legislation. Sessions referred to it, in fact, as a, quote, intrusive piece of legislation. Klobuchar also referenced enforcement of court rulings against things like photo ID voting restrictions, which have been found to be unlawful by a number of federal courts, including a very conservative appellate court in Texas last year. There were, during this questioning and as well a few others, various protests. This one not very loud. You may hear some of these interruptions in the background as Klobuchar is questioning Jeff Sessions.
You and I talked about how at one point you previously called the Voting Rights Act an intrusive piece of legislation. And I wondered if you could explain that as well as talk about how you will actively enforce the remaining pieces of the act. If you could just explain your views of the Voting Rights Act moving forward and what would happen in terms of enforcement if you were Attorney General.
The Voting Rights Act passed in 1965. Was one of the most important acts to deal with racial difficulties that we face. And it changed the whole course of history, particularly in the South. There was a clear finding that there was discriminatory activities in the South, that a number of states were systematically denying individuals the right to vote. And you go back into the history, you can see it plainly. Actions and rules and procedures were adopted in a number of states with the specific purpose of blocking African Americans from voting. And it was just wrong, and the Voting Rights Act confronted that. And it, in effect, targeted certain states and required any, even the most minor changes in voting procedure, right, like moving a precinct across.
So how would you approach this going forward? For instance, the Fifth Circuit's decision that the Texas voter ID law discriminates against minority voters that was written by a Bush appointee. Do you agree with that decision? How would you handle this moving forward?
Well, I have not studied that. There's going to be a debate about it. Courts are ruling on it now, and that is a voter ID, and whether or not that is a improper restriction on voting that adversely impacts disproportionately minority citizens. So that's a matter that's got to be decided. On the surface of it, it doesn't appear to me to be that. I have publicly said I think voter ID laws properly drafted are okay, but as Attorney General, it'll be my duty to study the facts in more depth, to analyze the law, but fundamentally that can be decided by Congress and the courts as they interpret the existing law. I did vote to extend the Voting Rights Act several years ago. I thought it included Section 5, but later Section 5 was eliminated by the Supreme Court on the basis that progress had been made. And this, and on an intrusive question, let me answer that. It is intrusive. The Supreme Court on more than one occasion has described it legally as an intrusive act because it only focused on a certain number of states, and normally when Congress passes a law, it applies to the whole country. So it's a very unusual thing for a law to be passed that targets only a few states. But they had a factual basis. They were able to show that it was justified in this fashion. So that's the foundation for it, and that's why I supported it, its renewal.
Mm-hmm. And I think you'll understand as you look at this issue that there are many voters, people who are trying to vote, that view some of these rules that are put in place as intrusive for them because it makes it harder for them to vote. And I think that is the balance that you're going to need to
strike. I hear
you. And I hope, coming from a state that has such high voter turnout, that has same-day registration, very good turnout in Iowa as well, right below us, states that have put in place some really expansive voter laws, and it doesn't mean Democrats always get elected. We've had Republican governors in Minnesota. We have a Republican governor in Iowa. And I just point out that I think the more we can do to encourage people to vote, the better democracy we have.
Yeah, well, Republicans are not always in favor of encouraging people to vote. That was Senator Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota with Jeff Sessions. Her colleague, Minnesota Senator Al Franken, then asked Sessions about his previous claims that he had filed 20 to 30 desegregation cases while serving as Attorney General of Alabama and as a federal U.S. attorney in the state. Here's that exchange with Al Franken and Jeff Sessions.
So tell me, did you file 20 or 30 desegregation cases, or is it some other number?
Well, thank you, Senator Franken. It is important for us to be accurate. The records don't show that there were 20 or 30 actually filed cases. Some of the cases involve multiple defendants and multiple parties, like to a school board and a county commission being sued for racial discrimination or things of that nature. But the number would be less than that, as we've looked at.
So what do you think would have caused you to say
I don't
that
know.
You
I
filed thought... 20 or 30 desegregation?
Well, we had cases going throughout my district, and some of them were started before I came and continued after I left. Some of them were brought and then settled promptly. And so it was extraordinarily difficult, actually, and I was surprised to get a record by checking the docket sheets to find out exactly how many cases were involved.
So it wasn't actually 20 to 30, as he had said on radio. I think he said, I just said it on radio.
Off the top of my head, I didn't have the records in front of me.
20 or 30, yeah. Apparently, it was not the truth. Al Franken from Minnesota then pressed the claims from Jeff Sessions in his responses to written confirmation. This was not on the radio. This was actually in response to written questions from senators, specifically a questionnaire for the confirmation hearing. And his claim that Sessions offered that he had personally, that's a quote, personally handled a number of civil rights cases that the Department of Justice Civil Rights Unit attorneys who actually wrote and worked on and filed those cases recently disputed in a Washington Post op-ed last week. We read that op-ed in full because it was so stunning that these civil rights attorneys were saying, three different ones who wrote this together, saying, no, we actually worked on the case, and we're not going to let Jeff Sessions take credit for it, since all he did was sign off on these cases as U.S. Attorney General in Alabama. They explained at the time that as part of the DOJ Civil Rights Unit, the attorneys put together these cases, worked on them in Washington, D.C., and that before they were then filed in the state of Alabama, where Sessions was serving as the U.S. attorney, he merely signed off on them, and he did not work on the cases at all. And they note that during his failed confirmation hearing to become a federal judge back in the 80s, Sessions didn't even cite those cases as ones that he personally handled or that he was most proud of, but he sure did this time around before his confirmation hearing on Tuesday.
The questionnaire you submitted for today asks you to list and describe the, quote, 10 most significant litigated matters you personally handled. And among the cases that you listed that you personally handle are three voting rights cases and a desegregation case. Last week, I should note, three attorneys who worked at DOJ and who actually brought three of the four cases wrote an op-ed piece in which they say, quote, we can state categorically that Sessions had no substantive involvement in any of them. Now, you originally said that you personally handled three of these cases, but these lawyers say that you had no substantive involvement. Are they distorting your record here?
Yes. In fact, one of the writers there, Mr. Hebert, spent a good bit of time in my office. He said I supported him in all the cases he brought, that I was more supportive than almost any other U.S. attorney, and that I provided office space, I signed the complaints that he brought. And as you know, may know, Senator Franken, when a lawyer signs a complaint, He's required to affirm that he believes in that complaint and supports that complaint and supports that legal action, which I did. We sued.
So that's your personal involvement? Was that your name was on it?
Well, look, you can dispute the impact or the import of the questionnaire. Another attorney, Paul Hancock, who brought cases in our district, said, well, the Attorney General claims credit for the cases in the Department of Justice. He saw nothing wrong with my claiming that this was a case that I had handled.
Okay, two of the...
So you can disagree with that, but those
I want to get through this, and I don't want you... I want to get through
on
this.
On the docket sheet, my name is listed number one on the attorney for the case.
These represent three of the four cases that you claimed that were among the top 10 cases that you personally handled. One of the cases that you listed was a case that Mr. Rich handled. So if you don't know him, it's hard for me to believe that you personally handled it.
Well, when I found that these cases, I had been supportive of. Sure, I was. Mr. Hebert says, quote, and yet I have needed Mr. Sessions' help in those cases, and he has provided that help every step of the way. In fact, I would say that my experience with Mr. Sessions has led me to believe that I have received more cooperation from him, more active involvement from him, because I have called upon him, close quote. Quote, I have worked side by side with him on some cases in the sense that I have had to go to him for some advice, close quote.
In some cases. We're not necessarily the ones you listed.
Well, look, okay, this was 30 years ago, and my memory was of this nature, and my memory was my support for those cases. When this issue was raised, I did do a supplemental that said I provided assistance and guidance to Civil Rights Division attorneys, had an open-door policy with them, and cooperated with them on these cases, close quote. I signed them, I supported cases, and attempted to be as effective as I could be in helping them be successful in these historic cases. I did feel that they were the kind of cases that were national in scope and deserved to be listed on the form. If I'm in error, I apologize to you. I don't think I was.
Well, you did. You couldn't find 20 or 30 desegregation cases that you stated you had participated in, and it don't sound like you personally handled cases that you said you personally.
Well, I was on a radio interview without any records, and that was my memory at the time.
There you go. Al Franken from Minnesota questioning Jeff Sessions at his hearing on Tuesday. Ted Cruz, senator from Texas, said that Sessions submitted. He talked a little bit more about that supplemental after his original answers to his questionnaire, claiming that he had personally handled those four civil rights cases, which the folks who worked on them said he did not. The additional paperwork, Cruz said, explained that he provided, quote, assistance and guidance on those civil rights cases, the ones that he had claimed previously until called out that he had handled personally. Franken said that if there's no difference in what he submitted in that supplemental, why did he bother to do so? Franken continued on this line and brought up the fact that Donald Trump has claimed there were millions of illegal votes cast in the 2016 election, asked Jeff Sessions if he agreed, and Franken followed up about the lack of fraud that actually exists and the bogus claims of voter fraud that are used by Republicans to justify voter suppression.
Do you agree with President Trump that millions of fraudulent votes were cast in the presidential election?
Senator Franken, I don't know what the president-elect meant or was thinking when he made that comment or what facts he may have had to justify his statement. I would just say that every election needs to be managed closely, and we need to ensure that there's integrity in it. And I do believe we regularly have fraudulent activities occur during election cycles.
Before we move on, I should note for the record that state election and law enforcement officials surveyed in mid-December found virtually no credible reports of fraud. Now, Senator Sessions, you have a complicated history with the Voting Rights Act. 10 years ago, when voting rights was a bipartisan issue, you voted to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. Everyone did, passed 98 to nothing. But you have also called the Voting Rights Act, quote, an intrusive piece of legislation. You have complained that the Act's preclearance requirement unfairly targeted certain states, and you have said that there is, quote, little present-day evidence that state and local officials restrict access to the franchise. You said that the Voting Rights Act has, quote, eliminated that discrimination. Well, Senator, after the Shelby County decision, which you celebrated, states began testing the limits of what they could do. And in many cases, citing the risk of so-called voter fraud as a justification for their actions. Now, that's what happened in North Carolina, for example. Just a few months after Shelby County, the state enacted one of the nation's strictest voter ID laws and enacted other restrictions. Without any evidence, the state described these changes as necessary to prevent fraud. Well, the courts disagreed. North Carolina's restrictions were challenged, and in July, the Fourth Circuit found the primary purpose of the restrictions wasn't to fight fraud, but to make it harder for black people to vote. Here's what the court said, and I quote, "The new provisions target African Americans with almost surgical precision." Do you still believe that there is little present-day evidence of states restricting access to the franchise? And if you do, what do you think the Fourth Circuit got wrong when it found that North Carolina targeted black voters with almost surgical precision? Do you accept that North Carolina was targeting African-American voters, but not believe that it was engaging in discriminatory conduct?
Well, you cannot create laws designed to inhibit the right of any class of citizens to vote. And so if the Fourth Circuit found that and there's a factual basis to support it, then any law that's passed would be subject to being either eliminated or altered. So I support your concern that laws of this kind cannot be used for that purpose. I do believe not long ago, the Supreme Court did uphold voter ID laws, but there are ways to do it and ways probably you cannot do it. So I am not familiar with the details of the North Carolina law, but you are correct. Any finding that's sustainable, that there's a racial animus in the passing of a law that would restrict voting, that law is could be unsustainable.
Could be unsustainable. That's Jeff Sessions, the man who would be responsible for filing lawsuits against states like that, against states like North Carolina, who were eventually found to have targeted black voters with surgical precision, as Al Franken said in that conversation.
I'm kind of disturbed that he is not familiar with that decision. It was
That's
a huge decision.
Yeah.
And he says, I'm not familiar with that decision.
Yep.
And he mentions, you know, improper reasons for restricting the vote. And what I found surprising is that none of the senators asked him, well, what are proper reasons for restricting the vote?
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody went to that one.
Well, they would be the type of voter fraud that he prosecuted back in the 80s against voting rights advocates, not just voting rights advocates, by the way. It was the guy who was marching behind John Lewis across the Selma Bridge on Bloody Sunday. That was one of the three voting rights advocates who were prosecuted by Jeff Sessions for voter fraud back in the 80s, who were acquitted, who were found to be not guilty. That same man, by the way, went on to lead the team of mules during
Martin Luther King's funeral
That's procession.
Right.
Yeah. That's who Jeff Sessions prosecuted for voter fraud in the past. That's who Jeff Sessions would be targeting now. Those same sorts of folks, because that's still who Republicans are out targeting for phony voter fraud claims. And for voter suppression claims. They then got into a debate about the Supreme Court gutting the Voting Rights Act. I don't think we're going to have time to play it here, unfortunately, debating the provisions, the Section 5 provisions, which were gutted by the Supreme Court, which required preclearance for new laws before new voting laws before they're implemented in jurisdictions like Jeff Sessions' home state of Alabama, states and other jurisdictions with a long history of racial discrimination. And they talked about voter suppression in elections. And while Section 2 of the Voting Rights still stands, and that's what was used in North Carolina that Jeff Sessions is not familiar with, that's what was used by the Department of Justice to get that finding, in fact, from the federal court, that Republican lawmakers in North Carolina had targeted African Americans with surgical precision. That Section 2 still stands, but it allows lawsuits against discrimination only after the fact, only after the laws have been implemented.
After the person has lost their right to vote in that election.
That's right, that's right. And Jeff Sessions, previously, while he did vote in favor of the extension of the Voting Rights Act some years ago, that was not a tough vote. I think it was 98-0 in the U.S. Senate. Everyone voted for that, I think by unanimous consent. He has since refused to help restore the section of the Voting Rights Act. It's actually Section 4, but that's the list of who gets to which jurisdictions have to face preclearance.
And he thought that was unfair, that these jurisdictions were being singled out, despite the fact that they have this very strong history of every time a new law would be struck down, they would put in a new one to take its place quicker, more quickly than prosecutors and the courts could then move to protect voting rights.
And that's what's happening now. Even after you know, these laws have been found over and over, like the photo ID restrictions have been found to be unlawful, unconstitutional, targeting African-American voters. He still and Republicans are still passing these laws all over the place, all in states across the country.
And that is what he said in his response to Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota when he said the courts will decide and Congress will decide what kinds of restrictions are okay, what kind of photo ID restrictions are okay. In other words, refusing to acknowledge the evidence that has come out and the court rulings that have come out already.
Well, exactly. And not only will the courts decide, but as the U.S. Attorney General, he's the guy who decides whether these cases will be brought in the first place. I mean, with days after, within days of the election, before they were even, you know, before they had even certified the results up in the state of Michigan, the Michigan legislature was already moving through a law of photo ID voting restriction. So, you know, he would have to make these decisions. And so far, as of now anyway, his fellow U.S. senators in the Judiciary Committee have not pressed him particularly hard. I think Franken's exchange with him that we don't have time for here was probably the toughest one that he's gotten so far. Anyway, let's take a quick break because that wasn't all that they talked about. And it wasn't all just voting rights and civil rights. The climate came up a little bit. We'll see if we have some time for that after this break. I know, Desi, you care about the climate. I don't. But we'll take a quick break and we'll be back with that in our coverage of Jeff Sessions' confirmation hearings in the U.S. Senate. I'm Brad Friedman. This is the Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad, and you're listening to the Bradcast on Radio Sputnik. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com covering Senator Sessions' confirmation hearings, the Donald Trump's nominee to be Attorney General of the United States. We've been focusing on his voting rights and civil rights record and the questions that came up from Minnesota senator. There was one, a Hawaii senator. And I've lost track
Maisie
of her name.
Hirono.
She's new. Hirono?
Yes. She was awesome. She did a really good job,
She
I think.
Did. She asked. She was very nice, like they all were. They were all incredibly polite, incredibly nice. I might suggest much more polite and much more nice than the moment calls for. But Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat from Rhode Island, asked Senator Sessions about his views on free speech, which Sessions claims to be in favor of. But then the White House narrowed the questions specifically about fraudulent speech, specifically then from corporations, and if that too is protected speech. Are corporations allowed to make fraudulent comments? He focused on the tobacco case, the big tobacco case in which Big Tobacco was found liable for billions of dollars after it was found that they had publicly lied about what they knew about the science and the dangers of smoking.
Is fraudulent speech protected by the First Amendment?
Well, fraudulent speech, if it amounts to an attempt to obtain a thing of value for the person the fraudulent speech is directed,
which is an element of fraud.
Absolutely fraud and can be prosecuted. And I think we see too much of that. We see these phone calls at night to elderly people. We see mailings go out that seem to me to be awfully far from truth and seducing people to probably make unwise decisions.
So fraudulent corporate speech would also not be protected by the First Amendment.
That is correct, and it's subject to civil and or criminal complaint.
And speaking of civil complaints, was the Department of Justice wrong when it brought and won the civil RICO action against the tobacco industry?
Well, Senator, they won those cases. They took them to court and eventually won a monumental victory. That is correct. And it's
hard to say
part of the law and firmly established.
Hard to say they were wrong if they won, right?
That's correct.
So what exactly was White House getting at there, Desi Doyen? Any idea? Was he laying a trap?
I think he was laying a pretty good steel trap right there for the supposed maybe presumptive attorney general coming in, Jeff Sessions, because when he mentions the tobacco industry lawsuit, the RICO statute under which it was prosecuted, that is exactly the same statute that that environmental groups are bringing right now to try to expose the fact that ExxonMobil lied about its own scientific research and funded climate science denial groups for decades. And then maybe possibly in New York, the Attorney General Schneiderman is also pursuing an investigation against Exxon based on the idea that they lied to their shareholders.
Now,
so that would be the statute under which Exxon would be prosecuted. I don't think Sessions understood what was going
on
with that question.
Because I don't know if he would have been quite as forthcoming to say, yeah, well, that's no, they're not allowed to commit fraud. And because the prosecution that's being modeled right now against ExxonMobil has been modeled on that big
RICO
tobacco
case.
It did not yet come up in the hearings. I didn't hear the word ExxonMobil yet. But Senator Sheldon Whitehouse later on in the hearing did have a Q&A. With Jeff Sessions about global warming and rising oceans, and how Jeff Sessions, who, like most elected Republicans, is a climate science denier, how he would deal with scientific fact.
You, as Attorney General of the United States, may be asked to make decisions for our nation that require a factual predicate in making a decision about the facts of climate change. To whom will you turn? Will you, for instance, trust the military, all of whose branches agree that climate change is a serious problem of real import for them? By the way, NASA is driving a rover around on the surface of Mars right now. So their scientists, I think, are pretty good. And so if that situation is presented to you, and you have to make a decision based on the facts, what can give us any assurance that you will make those facts based on real facts and real science?
That's a good and fair question, and honesty and integrity in that process is required. And if the facts justify a position on one side or the other on a case, I would try to utilize those facts in an honest and appropriate way. I don't deny that we have global warming. In fact, the theory of it always struck me as plausible. And it's the question of how much is happening and what the reaction would be to it.
So he doesn't deny we have global warming, Desi Doyen. Is he one of these guys who says, of course climate is changing. Climate always changes. It's changed since the beginning of time.
Well, that's one of those nuances that the deniers have moved on to. They've moved away from saying it's an outright hoax. Then they're saying that, oh, we don't cause it. Now he's like, oh, well, maybe we do, but we don't know how much, and we should figure that out first before we take action. So anyone who then advocates delaying taking action is, to me, still a denier.
Well, they are laying a trap, it seems, but they sure are taking their sweet time. And I don't think in the end, at least today, in those hearings, the first day of hearings for Jeff Sessions' nomination as Attorney General, I don't think the Democrats laid a glove on him,
nope.
In truth. All right. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, for slogging through all of that audio today. Maybe we'll have more tomorrow. And my thanks to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. And thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help us continue to do what we do here on the air every day. You can drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And you can find, follow, and share me on the Twitters and the Facebooks at The Brad Blog. That's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.